This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Well, Amazon, instead of being, you know, one of our carbon sinks, or some people like to call it the lungs of the earth, not going to do it anymore. Not going to be able to provide that ecosystem function that the globe depends on.
Depending on your point of reference, the term Amazon may evoke the mega retailer or a vast South American forest. This week on Sea Change Radio, we're speaking about the latter with author and conservation scientist Tim Killeen. We talk about his work in the Amazon region, his upcoming book, and what drew him to study this enormous, fragile ecosystem. We also learn about the policies that have contributed to an approximate 20% deforestation of the Amazon, discuss biocommerce in the area, and hear about some optimistic signs of regeneration. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author and conservation scientist Tim Killeen. Tim, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Nice to meet you, Alex.
So you're an expert on the Amazon, and you're publishing a book in conjunction with Manga Bay, which is going to be serializing this book, coming out with a few chapters at a time. Does it have a title yet? Is it called The State of the Amazon?
No, the name of the book, actually, it's being published in, it's more of a serial monograph is the way I refer to it. And so it's being published first by an academic publishing house, an environmental publishing house called the White Horse Press. And it's called A Perfect Storm in the Amazon Wilderness, a Success and Failure in the Fight to Save an Ecosystem of Critical Importance to the Planet. And so it's a rather large publication. There's 13 chapters. This is the third iteration. The first one was published in 2007. I had a version in 2019 that I couldn't get published, and now we're doing it for the third time and deciding to publish it via the Creative Commons so that it's online and open access, free for anybody who wants it. And it'll come out over the next couple of years.
And what drew you originally to this region of the world? Why the focus on the Amazon? Why don't you give us a little bit more of your backstory, if you can?
Okay, well, I guess it started in the 1970s. I had the great good fortune to share a house with a fellow from Bolivia. And so me and my first wife, mother of my children, we went and spent several years wandering around South America in the late 1979, 1980, 1981. We went to visit this fellow. That was our original motivation. But then we just started wandering around, and then we raised money based on our ability to do research there and establish contacts with institutions. But obviously, it was the nature of the biodiversity that attracted us to the area. This was in the 1980s. The word biodiversity hadn't even been coined yet. And so we went there to study the plants and the animals.
It seems like anybody who studied the Amazon has to be very attuned to the interplay between the indigenous population there, the very fragile ecosystems, and the market forces, the economics that are pushing and pushing constantly this area to the brink. Why don't you give us a little bit of an overview on some of the policies that led us to where we are now? First, let's focus on some of the more deleterious policies, if you can.
The rubber boom at the turn of the 19th, 20th century was really what transformed the Amazon. Before, there was diseases and stuff like this and missionaries and things. But, you know, with the rubber boom, there was this big influx of European and mestizo migrants that went into the region to exploit rubber. There was a second boom during World War II. And so this really seriously negatively impacted the indigenous people. This is, you know, they were already impacted by the great die-off following the Columbian Exchange. But then this, you know, it kind of happened all again in the rubber booms. And then what really got things going was in the 1960s and 70s, all of these countries, their governments, many of military governments at this point in time, decided that they had kind of dual issues of over, they were concerned about the population growth and inequality. And there was a big agitation for land reform. And so one of the ways they responded to those threats was to open up the Amazon, build highways into the Amazon, and give land away to everyone who wanted to go down there and knock down the forest and cultivate plants or grow cows or whatever. And so that started in the late 60s, really picked up speed in the 70s, exploded into the 80s, and just it's continued on after on. There's been ups and downs with the rates of migration. There was a massive, you know, millions of people moved into the Amazon in the late 1970s. It kind of dropped off in the 1990s, and now it's kind of an internal growth, lots of internal migration. And starting about 1990, about 1990, I guess, we started having the cultivation of intensive crops like soybeans. So it's a combination of policies, investments in infrastructure. I'm a scientist, so I study nature, but there are other scientists who study crops and cultivation. And so they developed very successful varieties of soybeans and breeds of cows that were well adapted to the region and started generating very significant amounts of cash flow that benefited the people who were moving into the area, benefited the economies of the country. And so things kept going and they've got out of hand. And now we have this deforestation crisis, which has been evolving for, you know, at least 35, 40 years. And like I said, ups and downs, and the late aughts and the early teens, there was an enormous decrease in deforestation due to policy changes in Brazil. But then, you know, there's been kind of a backlash and things are going in the other direction again. And people were very concerned, me amongst them, very concerned about the fate of the Amazon.
So, Tim, we're talking about the policies that led to the deforestation in the Amazon. What are some of the ones that you cover in the book and that we all should be aware of?
Yeah, no, the most obvious and infamous one was the decision to build highways. And the Brazilian military government in the 1970s, they actually had deliberate policies to build. They said, you know, people without land should live in the land without people, was their view of it. And so they built highways specifically into remote areas and specifically along their frontier areas, like on the border between Bolivia and Brazil, or the border between Brazil and say Venezuela. They specifically created colonies. They called them colonies back then, and encouraged people to move there. First, they encouraged smallholders as a way to relieve some of the social pressures and some of in their more settled areas. But then they realized that it was more profitable, if I can say that, to give away land to large landowners. And so they fostered then an additional policy. In addition to the one to giving land to poor people, they started giving a land away to corporations and, you know, literally giving it to them. In fact, actually giving them money to develop it. There was an institution called SUDAM in Brazil, and where they provided tax credits and subsidized loans to people who'd go in, and that helped them, you know, build a local road. You know, from first they built the interstate highway system, and then they started building local roads and gave money to people who were willing to cut down the forest and grow cows, basically, both the large and small scale. And similar type things happened in Bolivia and Peru and Colombia. Simultaneously, they were developing their mineral assets. There's parts of Peru that are just have these terrifically rich iron ore deposits. There's other parts with copper reserves, nickel, aluminum. There's very large aluminum deposits situated just, you know, basically in the above, right near the Amazon River, some of the largest aluminum mines in the world are in the Amazon, and bauxite mines, actually. And similar things happen in Peru where they have big copper mines, and those are up in the Andes, but they're part of the Amazon because they're in the Amazon basin. I treat them as being part of the Amazon. That water flows downhill and goes into the Amazon. And certainly culturally, the indigenous people of the highlands are now migrating massively into the lowlands of the Peruvian Amazon, have been doing it for 20 or 30 years. Most of them smallholders, most of them poor people moving from rural areas and where there's a lot of land tension and there's been very conflict. But there was a civil war in Peru during the 1990s with the Sendero Luminoso. So part of the policy response to that type of social upheaval was, hey, go to the Amazon and we'll give you land. And so these were policies that seemed coherent to their leaders of the time, and they're having the consequences now of this ever increasing population of farmers and ranchers that are settling along highways or mining. There's also this massive informal gold mining community, and all of the countries, all nine countries, have very large population of what they call wildcat miners. These are smaller operations, still industrialized. I estimate there's about 450,000 people engaged in the small scale mining industry, and that's and generating a lot of money. And so it's a part of this phenomenon. And of course, governments, if you know they don't foster it, they certainly tolerate it, you know, because there's, you know, there's so many of them, and they're well organized, and you know, local unions and stuff. And so it's difficult to say, oh no, we don't want you to do that, because these people are, they vote, and they're also volatile. They're willing to you know, blockade roads and stuff to protect their production systems. So those are, you know, one set of policies. And there's other, you know, like Brazil has this policy to generate electricity through dams. So they built lots of dams in the Amazon, which have their own impact, not on deforestation, but they certainly impede the river system, or the aquatic ecosystems that are dependent upon the river. There's all kinds of migratory fish. You build a dam, you mess with their life cycle. And so that's another group of policies, this time energy, to disrupt, you know, an aquatic ecosystem. They also discovered oil in Texaco, for instance, in the 1950s, discovered oil in Ecuador. And Ecuador is a member of OPEC. And so they've, you know, most of their oil comes from the Amazon. Peru, similar, Colombia, Bolivia, you know, even in Brazil has got this very large natural gas field right in the heart of the Amazon. And they generate money for the state and tax revenues and royalty revenues. But, you know, a lot of toxic chemicals and secondary impacts. Of course, you have, you know, if you have an oil well, you need to have a road to the oil well. So people settle along the road. So just all these things kind of feeding off one on the other. And we end up with the situation where we have an Amazon that's probably about 20% deforested, 18-19% they figure, which doesn't seem a lot, but it's, you know, it's also highly fragmented. If you look at the, you know, the penetration of the roads and the area that's, you know, maybe more like 40% of the Amazon has been impacted by some sort of human activity.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Tim Colleen. He's an author and conservation scientist. Tim, why don't you tell us more about biocommerce and how that will inform policymakers in the Amazon region moving forward?
So biocommerce is a new word that's been coined in the last decade, trying to describe economic activities that are compatible with forest conservation or compatible with the sustainable management of our freshwater fisheries, for instance. And so, you know, before we called it biocommerce, we called it forestry or the freshwater fisheries. And so these generate livelihoods for people. They certainly subsistence livelihoods. The fisheries, there's 2 or 3 million people in the Amazon that rely on fish that they catch or they buy in the local village or in the town or stuff. So fisheries are very important.
So just to define this term biocommerce, does it have to be some kind of ecologically friendly form of commerce, or is it just more of a umbrella term for anything from forestry to aquaculture, etc.
All of those definitions have probably been used at one time or another to describe biocommerce. The people who are in the logging industry, they like to think they're considered themselves to be part of the new biocommerce, and many of them are trying to adopt management practices. They call it sustainable forest management, that leave the forest intact and only take out a certain number of trees and stuff. And so they live alongside traditional loggers, and they all sell their wood to enter the domestic and foreign markets. So, you know, where does biocommerce start, and where does non-sustainable logging begin? That's tough nut to crack, actually. Same way with fisheries. Now there's this growing business of very successful of aquaculture, and they're using native species, and that's very good. And they seem to be convincing small producers or medium-sized producers to invest in that. And that's good, because if they're doing that, they're probably not cut down the forest or overfishing. And so there's a variety of things, but then there's this new traditional aspects too. For instance, Brazil nuts, a lot of the rubber collectors of the last century, they actually survived by harvesting three forest products, but rubber, when there was a market for rubber. And there was a market for rubber in Brazil because of a domestic policy to subsidize the Amazonian rubber industry. Talk about policy. There's an example, which ended in the 1980s. But they would collect rubber and Brazil nuts. And so they were in different seasons, and it gave them two products. And so now a lot of those people are just getting by on Brazil nuts and hunting and fishing and things like that. And in some instances, they're cutting down the forest as well. They'll have a small field of crops or cows and stuff. And so a lot of these rubber, these reserves that were set up as rubber reserves, and now if you look at them, you see lots of small scale, very restricted deforestations. People figure out how to live in the forest and make a living. And, you know, and they need cash income, because they want to educate their children. They have health needs. They're looking for a way for cash income. And so then you have these new crops, like acai, which is not new. It's been around for a millennium. The indigenous people have been eating it for thousands of years. And it's been a big domestic crop in Brazil for decades. But in the last decade, it's become, in the last 10 years, it's become an international phenomenon. And exports from Brazil have increased from about $100 million a year to almost $1 billion a year of acai, which is this palm that produces this purple, blue or purple fruit that's considered to be a superfood because it has antioxidants in it. And so at least where I see, you'll see a lot of these gyms, these health spas, they're also serving, you know, acai milkshakes or acai shakes or smoothies or whatever. So that's an example of a new type of global crop that's linked to Amazonian biocommerce. And it's coming out of a mixture of natural populations. Acai is a native palm, and it grows in what we call monodominant or oligodominant palm swamps, where there's just, you know, there'll be like a hectare, and there might be 1,000 trees in that hectare. They're very elegant, tall, slender palm, and so they can have high densities. And people are harvesting the fruits, and they're doing it without cutting them down. And so that's sustainable. But they're also figured out a way to talk about science. Embrapa, the Brazilian version of the USDA, their scientific agricultural research service, they've figured out a way to cultivate acai in upland forests using irrigation, because normally it's found in floodplains, where it's wet and soggy. But they figured out how to do it in upland with irrigation, and they're promoting it as a way to convert degraded pastures, which have been, you know, deforested over the last 40 or 50 years, as a way to restore those into it's still a cultivated crop. It's not a natural ecosystem, but there are trees, they're perennial, and they're generating income for the people who need an income.
So, Tim, you mentioned how deforestation has affected 20% of the Amazon. Give us an idea of what climate scientists are saying in terms of the trickle-down effect of that. Probably this is an enormous heat sink, for example, right?
Well, there's this thing called a tipping point. You've heard about tipping points where there's a you incrementally change something till you reach a critical cliff and then you fall off the cliff. Well, the precipitation regime, the rainfall in the Amazon might be approaching a tipping point. You see, the Amazon is a heat sink. You've described it. It's also a carbon sink, but it's also a giant water pump. And so most of the water that comes in the Amazon comes out of the Atlantic Ocean. You know, there's the planet rotates and the winds go from east to west. And so the rains in the Amazon originate over the Atlantic Ocean. But once they're over the Amazon, they're recycled. And so it rains and then the trees, these forests, there's massive pumps. They're just enormous water pumps. And this thing called evapotranspiration. So the water goes through the roots, through the leaves, and up in the atmosphere, and then it rains again. And that happens over and over again. And so the winds come across the Amazon, the rains come across the Amazon, and then they hit the Andes and then kind of veer south. And there's this phenomenon called the South American monsoon. Some people call them atmospheric rivers. And so all the water from the Amazon is then transported through the atmosphere down into the southern part of Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, which are very large agricultural production region. And so, you know, their agricultural production is dependent upon the Amazon as a source of water. And so there's a phenomenon with respect to this ability to recycle water, that the forest, forest recycles, you know, 10 times as much water as a pasture because the trees are, they have deeper roots and they're just more efficient at moving the water up and through, and they have a three-dimensional structure that preserves the humidity down below, et cetera. And so as you remove the forest, you are also damaging the capacity of the landscape to recycle this water. And it just so happens that there's a kind of a tipping point around 80%, 75, 80%, that when you remove 70, you know, 25, 30% of the forest cover, the rains start falling off dramatically, like, you know, 10, 20%. And so that's certainly true on the landscape scale. And you can see it, water, you know, precipitation levels all across the southern Amazon where, you know, I say, you know, 20% of the Amazon has been deforested, but in the southern Amazon, 40, 50, 60% of the forest has been removed. And so, you know, rainfall is dropping all across Mato Grosso, southern Pará, Bolivia, where I spend a lot of time. Also, there's, you know, a measurable decrease in you know, it's been measured. There's a decrease in precipitation. So people are concerned that the same phenomena, which has been proven at the landscape scale, will have a regional impact. And so maybe all of the southern Amazon will suddenly have its precipitation levels reduced. And that means the forest is going to not be a carbon sink, it's going to be a carbon source because it goes from a wet forest to a dry forest. It will start emitting carbon because the decay will be faster than the photosynthesis. There'll be less water to the south. It's a very serious macroeconomic problem because it could impact the agricultural production in the southern part of the continent by, you know, tens of billions of dollars annually. And the Amazon over the last, you know, 40 years, even though it's suffering massive carbon emissions from deforestation, massive carbon emissions, the rest of the forest is still sequestering carbon. And the intact forest has more than offset the losses of carbon due to deforestation until about 5 or 6 years ago, when our models, the people who do this for a living, who model forest cover, photosynthesis, precipitation, they're linked to all these global climate models. They're beginning to show that the Amazon is very close to being at a stage of equilibrium where the emissions from deforestation and forest degradation due to logging or wildfire and other problems is no longer being offset by the intact forest. And so the Amazon, instead of being, you know, one of our carbon sinks, or some people like to call it the lungs of the earth, not going to do it anymore. Not going to be able to provide that ecosystem function that the globe depends on.
So let's turn to some of the more hopeful signs in the region. What are some of the policies and events that give you hope for the future of the Amazon, Tim?
Protected areas. You know, when we went down in the 1980s as graduate students, there were no protected areas. So there was one or two, and they were unprotected. They were just paper parts, as they say. So all through the 90s and double aughts, these countries, with the assistance of the World Bank, the Global Environment Fund, USAID, the German Development Agency, the Norwegians, all Japanese, all kinds of, they said, hey, we need to create national protected area system. And, you know, and I think the protected area system in the Amazon is better than any other on the planet with respect to spatial area. 25% of the Amazon is now in a protected area, either national park or a forest reserve or a multiple use area. And so that's terrific, right? 25%. That's far more than we have in the United States or in Europe. And so that is a concrete accomplishment that these countries should be proud of. The other incidents that happened is at the same time, there was what I refer to as the indigenous awakening. You know, they were almost completely exterminated in the indigenous people. We're talking about the ethnic indigenous people, lowland ethnic, you know, there's like, I forget the number, but, you know, 250 of them that are still extant and groups. And so, you know, their population had fallen down to, you know, a couple hundred thousand and stuff, but they stood up and started demanding their rights, and they did it. Nobody gave it to them. They did it. They self-organized. And over the next 30, 40 years, they created national associations, which then became a basin-wide association. And they demanded their land. They demanded protection for their cultures. And they said, our cultures are dependent on our territory. And they demanded that they be given a tenure, either as property or as a reserve held by the state and them as a trust. And now approximately 25% of the Amazon is in the hands of indigenous people. So 25% protected areas, 25% in the hands of indigenous people who are actually better stewards of the land than the state. The statistics on deforestation and logging and so on and so forth all shows that indigenous people are excellent stewards of the land that we entrust to them. And so those are two just completely positive issues that have come out, and two policies that worked, international policies and domestic policies. You have to give everybody credit.
People can tune in to the semi-live publication of your three-volume opus on the Amazon via mangabay.com. Tim Killeen. Tim, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Meters and Neil Young. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site, or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.